looks up. Is he the guy who was selling wacky tobacco in high school? Hell, says Maddie, now genuinely indignant. That was 3 years ago. Everyone groans. Put a Milo on him, says Eric, and spits tobacco juice. A power-hitting outfielder. I'm not sure he wants to sign. He said he'd like to go to law school. Law school? He's getting pressure from his girlfriend, I think. He's looking for love, it sounds like. Put a Milo on him. Another collegiate left-handed pitcher. The guy's got no grades, says a scout. You mean bad grades, asks another. No, I mean no grades, says the first. How can a guy have no grades at Chico State, asks the other. He really has no desire at all to be in college, says the first scout, almost admiringly. This guy was designed to play ball. I'm not really jazzed about a guy who has no desire whatsoever to go to college, says Billy. That's not a badge of honor. Put a Milo on him. Billy doesn't interfere much in the search for bad makeup, and Paul says nothing at all. The meetings from their point of view are all about minimizing risk. They can't afford to have guys not work out. There's no point in taking risks on players temperamentally or legally unsuited to pro ball. At one point, Billy looks up and asks, "Who's that fucking guy we took last year we had to release because he robbed a bank?" The others are too absorbed in weeding out the bad makeup to reply or to even consider how remarkable the question is. Most of the first few days were devoted to culling the original pile of 680 players. Other than an excessive affection for one's girlfriend or a criminal record or other signs of bad makeup, there were just two reasons why the Oakland A's did not waste further time on a player. One was age. With rare exceptions, the new scouting directors toss all high school players immediately onto the dumping ground, leaving the younger scouts who spent their days following them wondering why they bothered. The other is what is delicately known in the draft room as expectations. What are his expectations, Eric Kubota asks, of a promising college pitcher? The scout who knows him best says, his dad said, and I quote, $4.2 million is a good place to start. Put him over there, Eric will say. When his name is tossed onto the dump heap, nobody in the front office cares. By the end of the third day, the scouts have organized the players into two groups. The prospects not worth considering further, and everyone else. The second group, maybe 400 players, they parse further by position. They'll rank 210 right-handed pitchers. They'll list 37 catchers, 1 through 37, and 94 outfielders, 1 through 94. But before they do, they turn their attention from eliminating players to selecting them. Billy's already made it clear that this year he has only a secondary interest in pitchers. The past few years he has stocked up on arms. It's the bats he needs. On the white board closest to Billy, the big board, there was space for 60 players. Only one slot had been filled. The first. Swisher. Nick Swisher, a center fielder from Ohio State. For the past 6 months before, Billy's been sure about Swisher, and he knows he won't get the slightest disagreement from his scouts. Swisher is a rare point of agreement between Paul's computer and the internal compass of an old baseball guy. He has the raw athletic ability the scouts adore, but he also has the stats Billy and Paul have decided matter more than anything. He's proven he can hit, and hit with power. He drew more than his share of walks. Oddly enough, Billy has never actually seen Swisher play. He had wanted to fly across the country to watch a few of Swisher's games, but his scouting department told him that if he did, word would quickly spread to the rest of Major League Baseball that Billy Bean was on to Nick Swisher. Swisher's stock would rise, and the odds that he'd still be around when the A's made this first pick, the 16th of the draft, would plummet. Operation Shutdown, the scouts called their project to keep Billy as far away from Swisher as they could. Operation Shutdown has had some perverse effects. One of them is to lead Billy to speak of Swisher in the needy tone of a man who has been restrained for too long from seeing his beloved. Swisher is his picture bride. Swisher is noticeable, isn't he? Says Billy, hoping to hear more about what Swisher looks like, how Swisher really is. Oh, he's noticeable, says an old scout. From the moment he gets off the bus, he doesn't shut up. His background is interesting, says Billy. His dad was a major league player. That's huge. A great chip in his favor. Those guys succeed. Swisher's dad is Steve Swisher, who caught for the Cubs, Cardinals, and Padres. He does have a presence, agrees an old scout. Did Operation Shutdown work? Asks Billy. Too well, says an old scout. Guy from the White Sox called me yesterday and said he knows you must be in love with Swisher because you haven't been to see him. Billy laughs. Out of this room, Swisher is hush-hush, he says. The conversation turns from Nick Swisher, and the moment it does, it becomes contentious. Not violently so. These are people with an interest in getting along. The tone of the conversation is that of a meeting in a big company that has just decided to drop a product line or shift resources from marketing to R&D. Still, it's a dispute with two sides riven by some fundamental difference. The two sides are, on the one hand, the old scouts, and on the other, Billy Bean. The old scouts are like a Greek chorus. It is their job to underscore the eternal themes of baseball. The eternal themes are precisely what Billy Bean wants to exploit for profit by ignoring them. One by one, Billy takes the names of the players the old scouts have fallen in love with and picks apart their flaws. The first time he does this, an old scout protests. The guy's an athlete, Billy, the old scout says. There's a lot of upside there. He can't hit, says Billy. He's not that bad a hitter, says the old scout. Yeah, what happens when he doesn't know a fastball is coming, says Billy. He's a tools guy, says the old scout defensively. The old scouts aren't built to argue. They are built to agree. They are part of a tightly woven class of former baseball players. The scout looks left and right for support. It doesn't arrive. But can he hit? Asks Billy. He can hit, says the old scout unconvincingly. Paul reads the player's college batting statistics. They contain a conspicuous lack of extra base hits and walks. My only question is, says Billy, if he's that good a hitter, why doesn't he hit better? The swing needs some work. You have to reinvent him. But he can hit. Pro baseball's not real good at reinventing guys, says Billy. Whatever happened when an older man who failed to become a big league star looks at a younger man with a view to imagining whether he might become a big league star, Billy wanted nothing more to do with it. He'd been on the receiving end of the dreams of older men, and he knew what they were worth. Over and over, the old scouts will say the guy has a great body, or this guy may be the best body in the draft. And every time they do, Billy will say, we're not selling jeans here, and deposit yet another highly touted player, beloved by the scouts, onto his shit list. One after another of the players the scouts rated highly vanish from the whiteboard until it's empty. If the Oakland A's aren't going to use their 7 first-round draft picks to take the players their scouts loved, who on earth are they going to take? That question begins to be answered when Billy Bean, after tossing another name on the slag heap, inserts another. Tian. The older scouts lean back in their chairs, spittoons in hand. Paul leans forward into a laptop and quietly pulls up statistics from college websites. Eric Kubota, scouting director, holds a ranked list of all the amateur baseball players in the country. He turns many pages and passes hundreds and hundreds of names before he finds Tian. Tell us about Tian, says Billy. Mark Tian, says Eric, is a third baseman from St. Mary's College just down the road in Moraga, California. Tian, says Eric. 6'3", 210. Left, right. Good approach to hitting. Not a lot of power right now. Our kind of guy. He takes pitches. Why haven't we talked about this guy before? Asks the old scout. It's because Tian doesn't project, says Eric. He's a corner guy who doesn't hit a lot of home runs. Power is something that can be acquired, says Billy quickly. Good hitters develop power. Power hitters don't become good hitters. "Do you see him at third base or shortstop?" asks another old scout, like a prosecuting attorney leading a witness. "Let's forget about positions and just ask, who is the best hitter?" says Billy. Paul looks up from his computer. "Tien. 493 on base, 624 slug. 30 walks and only 17 strikeouts in 194 at-bats." It's hard to tell what the scouts make of these numbers. Scouts from other teams would almost surely say, "Who gives a shit about a guy's numbers? It's college ball. You need to look at the guy. Imagine what he might become." Everyone stares silently at Tien's name for about 30 seconds. Eric says, "I hate to say it, but if you want to talk about another Jason Giambi, this guy could be it." Giambi was a natural hitter who developed power only after the Oakland A's drafted him, in the second round. Over the objections of scouts who said he couldn't run, throw, field, or hit with power. Jason Giambi, MVP of the American League in 2000. More silence. Decades of scouting experience are being rendered meaningless. "I hate to piss on the campfire," one of the scouts finally says, "but I haven't heard Tien's name once all year. I haven't heard other teams talking about him. I haven't heard his name around here all year. It wasn't like this guy was a 55 we all liked." The scouts put numbers on players. The numbers are one of the little tricks that lend scouting an air of precision. A player who receives a 55 is a player they think will one day be a regular big league player. "Who do you like better?" asks Billy. The old scout leans back in his chair and folds his arms. "What about Perry?" he says. "When you see him do something right on a swing, it's impressive. There's some work that needs to be done. He needs to be reworked a bit." "You don't change guys," says Billy. "They are who they are." "That's just my opinion," says the old scout and folds his arms. Once Tien has found his slot high up on the big board, Billy Bean takes out a magic marker and writes another name. Brown. The four scouts across from him either wince or laugh. Brown? Brown? Billy can't be serious. "Let's talk about Jeremy Brown," Billy says. In moving from Mark Tien, whoever he is, to Jeremy Brown, whoever he is, Billy Bean, in the scouting mind, had gone from the remotely plausible to the ridiculous. Jeremy Brown made the scouting lists. Just. He's listed on the last page where he clings to the bottom of the heap of what the scouts regard as, at best, low-level minor league players. He's a senior catcher at the University of Alabama. Only three of the old scouts saw him, and none of them rated him even close to a big leaguer. Each of them have about 1,000 players ranked above him. "Jeremy Brown is a bad body catcher," says the most vocal of the old scouts. "A bad body who owns the Alabama record books," says Pitter. "He's the only player in the history of the SEC with 300 hits and 200 walks," says Paul, looking up from his computer. It's what he doesn't say that is interesting. No one in big league baseball cares how much a college player walks. Paul cares about it more than just about anything else. He doesn't explain why walks are important. He doesn't explain that he has gone back and studied which amateur hitters made it to the big leagues and which did not and why. He doesn't explain that the important traits in a baseball player were not all equally important. That foot speed, fielding ability, even raw power tended to be dramatically overpriced. That the ability to control the strike zone was the greatest indicator of future success. That the number of walks a hitter drew was the best indicator of whether he understood how to control the strike zone. Paul doesn't say that if a guy has a keen eye at the plate in college, he'll likely keep that keen eye in the pros. He doesn't explain that plate discipline might be an innate trait rather than something a free-swinging amateur can be taught in the pros. He doesn't talk about all the other statistically based insights, the overwhelming importance of on-base percentage, the significance of pitches seen per plate appearance, that he uses to value precisely a hitter's contribution to a baseball offense. He doesn't stress the importance of generalizing from a large body of evidence as opposed to a small one. He doesn't explain anything because Billy doesn't want him to. Billy was forever telling Paul that when you try to explain probability theory to baseball guys, you just ended up confusing them. "This kid wears a large pair of underwear," says another old scout. It's the first time in 2 days that this old scout has spoken. He enjoys briefly the unusual attention accorded the silent man in a big meeting. The others in the room can only assume that if the scout was moved to speak, it must be because he had something earth-shatteringly important to say. He doesn't. "Okay," says Billy. "It's soft body," says the most vocal old scout. "A fleshy kind of a body."
"Oh, you mean like Babe Ruth?" says Billy.
Everyone laughs, the guys on Billy's side of the room, more happily than the older scouts across from him.
"I don't know," says the scout. "A body like that can be low energy."
"Sometimes low energy is just being cool," says Billy.
"Yeah," says the scout. "Well, in this case, low energy is because when he walks, his thighs stick together."
"I repeat, we're not selling jeans here," says Billy.
"That's good," says the scout, "because if you put him in corduroys, he'd start a fire."
Clutching Jeremy Brown's yellow nameplate, Billy inches towards the big board with the top 60 names on it. The scouts shift and spit. The leading scouting publication, Baseball America, has just published its special issue devoted to the 2002 draft, and in it, a list of the top 25 amateur catchers in the country. Jeremy Brown's name is not on the list. Baseball America has more or less said that Jeremy Brown will be lucky to get drafted. Billy Beane is walking Jeremy Brown into the first 5 rounds of the draft.
"Billy, does he really belong in that group?" asks the old scout plaintively.
"He went in the 19th round last year, and he'll be lucky to go there this year." The Red Sox had drafted Brown the year before, and Brown had turned down the peanuts they had offered and returned to the University of Alabama for his senior year. It was beginning to look like a wise move. The older scouts all share their brother's incredulity. One of them, the fat scout, when he returned from the trip Billy made him take to the University of Alabama, called Billy and told him that he couldn't recommend drafting Jeremy Brown. Full stop. There were 1,500 draft-eligible players in North America alone that he would rather own than this misshapen catcher. Like all the scouts, the fat scout had the overriding impression that Brown was fat and growing fatter. He had the further impression that Brown didn't look all that good when he did anything but hit. "Behind the plate, he's not mobile," the fat scout now says. "His throws are all slingshot throws."
Throws from catcher with a slinging motion tend not to follow a straight line, but tail off towards the first base side of second base. Billy takes a step towards the big board, sticks Brown's name onto the top of the big board's second column, the 17th slot, and says, "All right, push him down, guys." Jeremy Brown is now a high second round or even low first round draft pick. If baseball scouts were capable of gasping, these men would have gasped. Instead, they spit tobacco juice into their cups. That was the moment when the scouts realized just how far Billy Beane was willing to go to push his supposedly rational and objective view of things.
"Come on, Billy," the vocal scout says.
"Finding a catcher who can hit. There's not one of them out there who can hit," says Billy. "This guy can hit."
Eric looks across the table and says, "This guy is a senior with, like, a huge history."
The scouts don't see the point of history. In their view, history isn't terribly relevant when you're talking about kids who haven't become who they will be.
"Come on," says Eric. "You guys have all played with guys who were bad bodies and good baseball players."
"Yeah," says Billy. "I played with Pitter."
Everyone laughs, even Pitter.
"Another thing about Brown," says Billy. "He walks his ass off."
"He's leading the country in walks," says Paul.
"Walks."
"He better walk because he can't run," says one of the scouts.
"That body, Billy," says the most vocal old scout. "It's not natural."
He's pleading now.
He's got big thighs, says the fat scout, thoughtfully munching another jumbo-sized chocolate chip cookie. A big butt. He's huge in the ass. Every year that body has just gotten worse and worse and worse, says a third. Can he hit, though? Asked Billy Bean. Want to hear something? Said Paul, gazing into his computer screen at the University of Alabama website. In the past 2 years, 390 at-bats, 98 walks, 38 Ks. Those numbers are better than anyone's in minor league baseball. Oh, yeah. 21 jacks. Jacks are home runs. So are dongs, bombs, and big flies. Baseball people express their fondness for a thing by thinking up lots of different ways to say it. The fat scout looks up from his giant chocolate chip cookie and seeks to find a way to get across just how unimpressed he is. Well, he says, exaggerating his natural drawl, I must have severely underestimated Jeremy Brown's hitting ability. I just don't see it, says the vocal scout. That's all right, says Billy. We're blending what we see, but we aren't allowing ourselves to be victimized by what we see. This argument had nothing to do with Jeremy Brown. It was about how to find a big league ball player. In the scout's view, you found a big league ball player by driving 60,000 miles, staying in 100 crappy motels, and eating God knows how many meals at Denny's, all so you could watch 200 high school and college baseball games inside of 4 months, 199 of which were completely meaningless to you. Most of your worth was in your membership in the fraternity of old scouts who did this for a living. The other little part was the one time out of 200 when you would walk into the ballpark, find a seat on the aluminum plank in the fourth row directly behind the catcher, and see something no one else had seen. At least, no one who knew the meaning of it. You only had to see him once. If you see it once, it's there, says Eric. There's always been that belief in scouting. And if you saw it once, you and only you would know the meaning of what you saw. You had found the boy who was going to make you famous. Billy had his own idea about where to find future Major League Baseball players. Inside Paul's computer. He'd flirted with the idea of firing all the scouts and just drafting the kids straight from Paul's laptop. The internet now served up just about every statistic you could want about every college player in the country, and Paul knew them all. Paul's laptop didn't have a tiny red bell on top that whirled and whistled whenever a college player's on-base percentage climbed above 450, but it might as well have. From Paul's point of view, that was the great thing about college players. They had meaningful stats. They played a lot more games against stiffer competition than high school players. The sample size of their relevant statistics was larger, and therefore a more accurate reflection of some underlying reality. You could project college players with greater certainty than you could project high school players. The statistics enabled you to find your way past all sorts of sight-based scouting prejudices. The scouting dislike of short right-handed pitchers, for instance, or the scouting distrust of skinny little guys who get on base, or the scouting distaste for fat catchers. That was the source of this conflict. For Billy and Paul, and to a slightly lesser extent Eric and Chris, a young player is not what he looks like or what he might become, but what he has done. As elementary as that might sound to someone who knew nothing about professional baseball, it counts as heresy here. The scouts even have a catchphrase for what Billy and Paul are up to. Performance scouting. Performance scouting in scouting circles is an insult. It directly contradicts the baseball man's view that a young player is what you can see him doing in your mind's eye. It argues that most of what's important about a baseball player, maybe even including his character, can be found in his statistics. After Billy said what he had to say about being victimized by what we see, no one knew what to say. Everyone stared at Jeremy Brown's name. Maybe then they all understood that they weren't here to make decisions. They were here to learn about the new way that the decisions were going to be made. This is a cutting-edge approach we're taking this year, says Eric, whose job, it is increasingly clear, is to stand between Billy and the old scouts and reconcile the one to the other. 5 years from now, everyone might be doing it this way.
I hope not, says Paul.
He doesn't mean this in the way that the old scouts would like him to mean it. Bogey, says Eric, calling across the table on the vast moral authority of the oldest scout of all, Dick Bogard. Does this make sense to you? Eric adores Bogey, though of course he'd never put it that way. When Eric announced he wanted to leave the A's advertising department and get into the baseball end of things, even though he himself had never played, Bogey not only did not laugh at him, he encouraged him.
My baseball father, Eric called Bogey.
Bogey is not merely the oldest of the scouts. He is the scout who has worked for the most other teams. He is a walking map of his own little world. In spite of his age, or maybe because of it, he knows when an old thing has died.
Oh, definitely, says Bogey, motioning to Paul's computer. It's a new game. Years ago, we didn't have these stats to look up. We had to go with what we saw.
Years ago, it only cost $100,000 to sign them, says Eric.
The other older scouts are unmoved.
Look, says Eric, Pitter and I are the ones that people are going to say, what the hell were you doing? How the hell could you take Brown in the first round?
No one says anything.
The hardest thing, says Billy, is there a certain pride or lack of pride required to do this right. You take a guy high no one else likes and it makes you uncomfortable. But I mean, really, who gives a fuck where guys are taken? Remember Zito? Everyone said we were nuts to take Zito with the 9th pick of the draft, and we knew everyone was going to say that. One fucking month later, it's clear we kicked everyone's ass.
Nobody remembers that now.
But understand, when we stop trying to figure out the perception of guys, we've done better.
Jeremy Brown isn't Zito, says one of the scouts.
But he is. A lot of people in the room have forgotten that the scouting department hadn't wanted to take Barry Zito because Barry Zito threw an 88-mile-per-hour fastball. They preferred a flamethrower named Ben Sheets.
Billy made us take Zito, Bogey later confesses.
Let me ask you this, says Billy. If Jeremy Brown looked as good in a uniform as Majewski, a Greek Kouros who played outfield for the University of Texas, where on this board would you put him? The scouts pretend to consider this. Nobody says anything, so Pitter says it for them. He'd be in that first column. A first-round pick.
You guys really are trying to sell jeans, aren't you? Says Billy.
And on that note of affectionate disgust, he ends the debate. He simply takes Jeremy Brown's nameplate and moves him from the top of the second column on the big board to the bottom of the first, from number 17 to number 15. Jeremy Brown, whose name had somehow failed to turn up on Baseball America's list of top 25 amateur catchers, who serious scouts believed should never be a pro baseball player, is now a first-round draft choice of the Oakland A's.
Since we're talking about Brown anyway, says Paul, which wasn't exactly true since the scouts were now distinctly not talking about Brown, there's a list of hitters I want to talk about. All of these guys share certain qualities. They are the 8 guys we definitely want, and we want all 8 of these guys.
He reads a list. Jeremy Brown, Stephen Stanley, John Baker, Mark Keeger, Sean Larkin, John McCurdy, Brant Colomarino, Brian Stavisky. All 8 are college players. Most of them are guys the scouts either did not particularly like or in a few cases don't really know. A young man rises to put their names on the board. Paul quickly organizes them like a dinner guest who has spilled his wine and hopes to clean it up before the host notices. When he's finished, the board is a market, but from a particular point of view, that of a trader who possesses, or believes he possesses, superior knowledge. With that, the coup was complete. Paul's list of hitters were distinctly not guys the scouts found driving around. They were guys Paul found surfing the internet. Some of the names the older scouts do not even recognize. The evaluation of young baseball players had been taken out of the hands of old baseball men and placed in the hands of people who had what Billy valued most and what Billy didn't have, a degree in something other than baseball. "There's some serious on-base percentage up there," says Billy. No one else says anything. The room is filled with silence. "We got three guys at the top of the board that no one has ever heard of," Pitter finally says, with just a trace of pride. "There isn't a board in the game that looks like this one," agrees Bogey. Bogey brought into the draft room something unique, vast experience to which he had no visceral attachment. He'd been in the game for nearly 50 years. He'd seen a lot, perhaps everything, and he was willing to forget it if asked. As it happened, one of the things he had seen back in 1980 was a high school game in San Diego. That was the year that the Mets took Darryl Strawberry with the first overall pick in the draft. But that year there was another high school player, a player who, in his ability to conjure fantasies in the baseball scouting mind, rivaled Strawberry. Bogey had gone to see him at the behest of the Houston Astros. Great body, plus wheels, plus arm, good instincts, and the ability to hit the ball over light towers. To top it off, he'd scored higher than any other prospect on the psychological tests. Bogey had phoned Houston and told the front office that he had found a better prospect than Darryl Strawberry. Billy Beane. When asked which player on the Oakland A's draft board most resembled the young Billy Beane, Bogey said, "Shit, man. There is no Billy Beane. Not up there." When asked why, he'd said Billy was a guy you could dream on, and left it to you to understand that Billy Beane, the general manager, had just systematically eliminated guys you could dream on. But when asked what became of those still unforgotten dreams, Bogey hesitated. He looked over and met the eye of the grown-up Billy Beane. "That's enough," said Billy. He'd only been pretending not to listen. Bogey just smiled, shrugged, and said no more. Chapter 3. The Enlightenment. The Mets had had only the greatest expectations of him. They'd wanted to hold a big press conference in Dodger Stadium to announce his signing. Billy asked them not to. He had a claustrophobic unease with ceremony of any kind, and a press conference was nothing but a ceremonial event. It'd make him feel trapped. Plus, he didn't want to make a big deal about becoming a pro baseball player. It was less a decision to celebrate than a vaguely uncomfortable fact to get his mind around. The Mets failed to consider the cause or implications of his reticence. In the belief that Billy was more ready for pro ball than Darryl Strawberry, they sent Strawberry to the low-level rookie team with the other high school kids and Billy to the high-level rookie team in Little Falls, New York, with the college players. Little Falls, New York could not have felt further from San Diego, California. His teammates might as well have been a different species than the high school kids he was used to playing with. They had hair on their backs and fat on their stomachs. They smoked before games and drank after them. A few had wives, and all of the pitchers had sliders. The Mets were betting that Billy was better equipped than Strawberry to deal with the pressures and inevitable frustrations that went along with playing against much older players. Roger Youngeward, the Mets' head scout, fully expected Billy to rocket through the minors and into the big leagues well ahead of Strawberry. The Mets' scouting department had badly misjudged Billy's nature. They had set him up to fail. If there was one thing Billy was not equipped for, it was failure. He didn't even begin to know what to make of a stat sheet at the end of his first short season in high-level rookie ball that showed him hitting .210. He didn't know how to think of himself if he couldn't think of himself as a success. When the season ended, he returned home, enrolled in classes at the University of California at San Diego, and forgot that he played baseball for a living. He didn't so much as pick up a bat or a glove until spring training the following March. That in itself should have been an ominous sign, but no one was looking for ominous signs. The next year went well enough for him. He was, after all, Billy Beane, and by the summer of 1982, he had been promoted to the Mets' AA team in Jackson, Mississippi. He played left, Strawberry played right, and the whole team played the field. For a lot of the players, it was their first exposure to the Southern female, the most flagrant cheater in the mutual disarmament pact known as feminism. Lipstick, hairdos, submissiveness. Baseball was a game, but chasing women was a business in which Billy Bean was designed to succeed without even trying. Billy had the rap. Billy, said his old teammate J.P. Ricciardi, could talk a dog off a meat wagon. Billy was forever having to explain to another teammate of his, Steve Springer, that when you just met some girl, what you didn't do was tell her you played pro ball. It wasn't fair to her. You had to give the girl a chance to turn you down. Billy's way of giving her a chance was to tell her that what he did for a living was collect roadkill off local highways. Springer didn't have Billy's awesome, God-given ability with women. He thought he needed the Mets to stand a chance, and this need of his led to one of those great little moments that make even the most dismal minor league baseball careers worth remembering. They were leaving one of the local burger joints when two pretty girls called after them in their fetching drawls. "You boys, Yankees." Springer turned around and said, "No, we're the Mets." Off the field, Billy was Billy. On the field, Billy was crumbling. The only thing worse than an ambivalent minor league baseball player was an ambivalent minor league baseball player with a terror of failure, forced to compare himself every afternoon to Daryl Strawberry. People would look at Billy and Daryl and think about the untapped potential that might be brought out of them, recalls Jeff Bittiger, who was the ace of the staff on the same team. They weren't just supposed to be big leaguers. They were supposed to be big league all-stars. That year, Strawberry would be named the most valuable player in the Texas League. Billy would hit only 220. Often they'd hit third and fourth in the lineup, and so Billy spent a lot of hours in the outfield dwelling on Strawberry's heroics and his own failure. "That was the first year I really questioned if I'd made the right decision to sign," Billy said. Daryl Strawberry presented one kind of problem for Billy. Lenny Dykstra presented another, perhaps even more serious one. Billy and Lenny lived together and played side by side in minor league outfields for nearly 2 years, beginning in 1984. In the spring of that year, both were invited to the Mets' big league spring training camp. With Strawberry now a fixture in the Mets' right field, the talk in the minors was that Billy was being groomed to replace George Foster in left, and Lenny was supposed to replace Mookie Wilson in center. Lenny thought of himself and Billy as two buddies racing together down the same track, but Billy sensed fundamental differences between himself and Lenny. Physically, Lenny didn't belong in the same league with him. He was half Billy's size and had a fraction of Billy's promise, which is why the Mets hadn't drafted him until the 13th round. Mentally, Lenny was superior, which was odd considering Lenny wasn't what you'd call a student of the game. Billy remembers sitting with Lenny in a Mets dugout watching the opposing pitcher warm up. Lenny says, "So who's that big dumbass out there on the hill?" And I say, "Lenny, you're kidding me, right? That's Steve Carlton. He's maybe the greatest left-hander in the history of the game." Lenny says, "Oh, yeah, I knew that." He sits there for a minute and says, "So what's he got?" I say, "Lenny, come on. Steve Carlton. He's got heat, and also maybe the nastiest slider ever." And Lenny sits there for a while longer as if he's taking that in. Finally, he just says, "Shit, I'll stick him." I'm sitting there thinking, that's a magazine cover out there on the hill, and all Lenny can think is that he'll stick him. The point about Lenny, at least to Billy, was clear. Lenny didn't let his mind screw him up. The physical gifts required to play pro ball were in some ways less extraordinary than the mental ones. Only a psychological freak could approach a 100-mile-per-hour fastball aimed not all that far from his head with total confidence. "Lenny was so perfectly designed emotionally to play the game of baseball," said Billy. "He was able to instantly forget any failure and draw strength from every success. He had no concept of failure, and he had no idea of where he was. And I was the opposite." Living with Lenny, Billy became less sure that he was destined to be the star everyone told him he would be. He began in the private casino of his mind to hedge his bets. He told teammates he might quit baseball and go back to college and play football. He might enter politics. Everyone said he'd be good at it. He took to reading some nights, a radical idea for a minor league baseball player, to compensate for the formal education he now realized he wasn't getting. Lenny would come home and find Billy curled up in a chair with a book. He'd look at me, recalls Billy, and say, "Dude, you shouldn't be doing that. That shit'll ruin your eyes." Lenny's attitude was, "I'm going to do nothing that will interfere with getting to the big leagues, including learning." Maybe, more to the point, Lenny, a 13th-round draft pick, hadn't the slightest doubt that he was going to make it to the big leagues and make it big. "I started to get a sense of what a baseball player was," Billy said, "and I could see it wasn't me. It was Lenny." That thought led to another. "I'm not sure I like it here." Before Billy was sent back to the minor leagues in the first cuts of 1984 spring training, he was confronted by the Mets' big league manager, Davy Johnson. Johnson told Billy that he didn't think he, Billy, really wanted to play baseball. "I didn't take it as a criticism," said Billy. "I took it as, I think he's right. I was so geared to going to college. I was sort of half in and half out." The half that was in stayed in. He didn't quit baseball. He kept grinding his way up through the minor leagues, propelled by his private fears and other people's dreams. The difference between who he was and who other people thought he should be grew by the day. A lot of people who watched Billy Bean play still thought what J.P. Ricciardi thought when he played with Billy that first year in Little Falls. "He was so physically gifted that I thought he would overcome everything," said Ricciardi. "I remember coming home from that first season and telling my friends, 'I just played with this guy who you gotta see to believe. He isn't like other animals.'" Teammates would look at Billy and see the future of the New York Mets. Scouts would look at him and see what they had always seen. The hose, the wheels, the body, the good face. Billy was smart enough to fake his way through his assigned role. Young man of promise. "Billy never looked bad, even when he struggled," recalls the scout who had signed him, Roger Youngewart. "He was the most talented player I ever played with," says Chris Pitaro, who made it to the big leagues with the Tigers and won a World Series with the Twins. "He had the ability to do things in a game that 95% of the people in the big leagues could not do in practice because they didn't have the physical ability. There aren't many plays I remember from 15 years ago, but I remember some of Billy's. We were in Albuquerque in 87, in AAA ball, and Billy made this play in right field. He had to run up and down over the bullpen mound to make a catch, and then throw a tagging runner out at the plate. I remember being astonished, first of all, that he even got to the ball. Second, that he ran up and down a pitcher's mound at full speed without breaking stride. Third, that he even thought to make that throw. Speed, balance, presence of mind. I think that the runner, when he found the ball waiting for him, was more surprised than anybody. Billy could run, and Billy could throw, and Billy could catch, and Billy even had presence of mind in the field. Billy was quick-witted and charming and perceptive about other people, if not about himself. He had a bravado, increasingly false, that no one in a 50-mile radius was ever going to see through. He looked more like a superstar than any actual superstar. He was a natural leader of young men. Billy's weakness was simple. He couldn't hit. Or rather, he hit sometimes, but not others. And when he didn't hit, he unraveled. "Billy was of the opinion that he should never make an out," said Pitaro. Relief pitchers used to come down from the bullpen to watch Billy hit, just to see what he did when he struck out. He busted so many bats against so many walls that his teammates lost count. One time he destroyed the dugout toilet. Another time, in a AAA game in Tacoma, he went after a fan in the stands and proved, to everyone's satisfaction, that fans, no matter what challenges they hollered from the safety of their seats, were better off not getting into fistfights with ballplayers. From the moment Billy entered a batter's box, he set about devouring himself from the inside until, fully self-consumed, he went looking around him for something else to feed his rage. He didn't have a baseball mentality, said Jeff Bittiger. He was more like a basketball or a football player. Emotions were always such a big part of whatever he did. A bad at-bat or two, and he was done for the third and fourth at-bats of the game. Yet even inside the batter's box, where he came unglued in a matter of a few seconds, Billy enjoyed sensational success. In 1983, in response to a special inconsistency against right-handed pitching, Billy played around with switch hitting. Who tried hitting from the wrong side of the plate for the first time in his life in double-A ball? Nobody. And yet by the middle of the double-A season, against pitchers with big league stuff, Billy was hitting 300 left-handed. Then he slumped and lost his nerve. He went back to hitting exclusively right-handed. In late 1984, Billy and Lenny both came up for a few weeks at the end of the season. Billy got his first big league hit off Jerry Kuzman, who immediately picked him off first base. It was funny. It was also sad. Just as the game seemed willing to bend to his talent, it snapped back and took whatever it had just given him away. In late 1985, Lenny was brought up for good to the big league team, for which Daryl Strawberry already had hit more than 70 home runs. Lenny played center, Strawberry played right. Billy played the guy who never made it out to left field. The next year, Lenny hit the home run that won the deciding game of the World Series and wrote a book about it, in which he mentioned that it should have been Billy Beane, not he, who became the big league star. Lenny didn't read books. He wrote them. Rather than make Billy a big leaguer, the Mets traded him to the Minnesota Twins. The Twins in 1986 had a new manager, Ray Miller, who announced that Billy Beane would be his starting left fielder. Billy immediately went out and hurt himself in spring training, but when he came back, he was, for the first time in his big league career, sent out to left field as a regular rather than a substitute. That day, the Twins were in Yankee Stadium facing Ron Guidry. Billy went 5 for 5 off Guidry with a home run. Then he went hitless the next two nights and found himself written out of the Twins' starting lineup. For good, as it turned out. Billy understood, or said he did. The team was losing, and Ray Miller was new and feeling pressure to play veterans. The next 3.5 seasons, Billy was up and down between AAA and the big leagues, with the Twins, the Detroit Tigers, and finally with the Oakland A's. Inside the batter's box, he struggled to adapt, but every change he made was aimed more at preventing embarrassment than at achieving success. To reduce his strikeouts, he shortened his swing and traded the possibility of hitting a home run for a greater likelihood of simply putting the ball in play. He crouched and hunched in an attempt to hit like a smaller man. He might have struck out less than he otherwise would have done, but at the cost of crippling his natural powers. 8 years into his professional baseball career, he was, in some ways, a weaker hitter than when he was 17 years old. At least, when it counted. When it didn't count, when he didn't think about it, anything could happen. One afternoon during Billy's one-month stint with the Detroit Tigers, he was asked by the general manager, Bill LaJoie, to come out to Tiger Stadium on an off day. LaJoie called in a few scrubs to help with the rehabilitation of a pitcher named Walt Terrell. Terrell, who had been injured, was about to re-enter the Tigers' starting rotation. Before that happened, the pitching coach wanted Terrell to throw a simulated game. Billy was expected to stand in the box as a foil. Once they'd taken the field, there was just one thought on everyone's mind. Was Terrell his old self? Billy sat and watched Terrell dispatch a couple of hitters. He was indeed his old self. When Billy's turn came to hit, nobody was paying him any attention. All eyes were on Terrell. Nobody much cared whether Billy Beane struck out or hooted at the moon. He couldn't fail. He became, for a moment, a boy playing a game. While the coaches and the GM scrutinized their precious pitcher, Billy took the first pitch he liked and launched a major league fastball into the upper deck of Tiger Stadium. There was a new thought on everyone's mind. Who the fuck did that? Billy was no longer ignorable. The GM, LaJoie, came over to him. Billy, you look like a different guy. The stance, the attitude, everything was different. Why don't you do that all the time? By now, everyone knew that Billy was the guy destined for the Hall of Fame, who never panned out. He was still at an age when he might have developed further as a player, said LaJoie. The GM thought there was hope. The GM really didn't understand. Nobody understood. Inside a batter's box, during a baseball game, Billy was no longer able to be himself. Billy was built to move. Inside a batter's box, he had to be perfectly still. Inside a batter's box, he experienced a kind of claustrophobia. The batter's box was a cage designed to crush his spirit. In his last 3.5 years of pro ball, Billy watched a lot more baseball than he played and demonstrated an odd knack for being near the center of other people's action. The Forrest Gump of baseball, he later called himself. He was on the bench when the Twins won the 1987 World Series and also when the A's won the 1989 World Series. He was forever finding himself next to people who were about to become stars. He'd played outfield with Lenny Dykstra and Daryl Strawberry. He'd subbed for Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco. He'd lockered beside Ricky Henderson. In his slivers of 5 years in the big leagues, he played for 4 famous managers: Sparky Anderson, Tom Kelly, Davey Johnson, and Tony La Russa. But by the end of 1989, his career stat line, 301 at-bats, 219 batting average, 246 on-base percentage, 296 slugging percentage, and 11 walks against 80 strikeouts, told an eloquent tale of suffering. You didn't need to know Billy Beane at all. You only needed to read his stats to sense that he left every on-deck circle in trouble, that he had developed neither discipline nor composure, that he had never learned to lay off a bad pitch, that he was easily fooled, that fooled so often he came to expect that he would be fooled, that he hit with fear, that his fear masqueraded as aggression, that the aggression enabled him to exit the batter's box as quickly as possible. One season in the big leagues, he came to the plate 79 times and failed to draw a single walk. Not many players do that. Billy's failure was less interesting than the many attempts to explain it. His teammate and friend, Chris Pitaro, said, "Billy was as competitive and intense as anyone I ever played with. He never let his talent dictate. He fought himself too hard." Billy's high school coach, Sam Blaylock, said he would have made it if he'd had the intangibles, if he would have had a better self-image. I think he would have been a big star in the big leagues. No, I know. He was amazing. If he'd wanted to, he could even have made it as a pitcher. The scouts, who had been so high on Billy when he was 17 years old, still spoke of him in odd tones when he was 25, as if he'd become exactly what they all said he would be, and it was only by some piece of sorcery that he didn't have the numbers to prove it. Paul Weaver. The guy had it all. But some guys just never figure it out. Whatever it is that allows you to perform day in, day out, and to make adjustments, he didn't have it. The game is that way. Roger Youngerwart. He had the talent to be a superstar. A Mike Schmidt-type player. His problem was makeup. I thought Billy had makeup on his side. But he tried too hard. He tried to force it. He couldn't stay loose. Inside baseball, among the older men, that was the general consensus. Billy Beane's failure was not physical, but mental. His mind had shoved his talent to one side. He hadn't allowed nature to take its course. It was hardly surprising that it occurred to the older men that what Billy really needed was a shrink. That, briefly, is what he got. The whole idea of a baseball shrink had been reinvented by the Oakland A's in the early 1980s. There'd been some flirtation with shrinking players back in the late 1940s. The old St. Louis Browns hired a psychologist who specialized in hypnotic therapy named David Tracy. Tracy wrote a book about his experience called Psychologist at Bat, which, if nothing else, gives you some idea why baseball didn't rush to embrace the psychiatric profession. Here's Tracy describing his technique. "I had a Browns pitcher lie down on the couch, and I stood behind him. I held up my finger about 6 inches above his eyes and told him to look at it steadily as I talked. 'Your legs are growing heavy, very heavy. Your arms are growing heavy, very heavy. You are going deep, deep asleep. The first of the new breed was a charismatic former prep school teacher with some academic training in psychology named Harvey Dorfman. The A's minor league coordinator Carl Kuehl, with whom Dorfman wrote the seminal book The Mental Game of Baseball, had actually put Dorfman in uniform and let him sit in the dugout during games so he could deal with the players' assorted brain screams in real time. Kuehl had no time for a player's loss of composure during a game. If you were throwing equipment or whatever, you were going to spend time with Harvey, whether you wanted to or not, said Kuehl. One of the most efficient destroyers of baseball equipment his teammates had ever seen, Billy was destined to spend time with Harvey. Harvey's main impression of Billy was that Billy had played hide-and-seek with his demons and that professional baseball had helped him to win. Baseball organizations don't understand that with a certain kind of highly talented player who has trouble with failure, they need to suck it up and let the kid develop, Dorfman said. So you don't push him along too fast. Take it slow so his failure is not public exposure and humiliation. Teach him perspective, that baseball matters, but it doesn't matter too much. Teach him that what matters isn't whether I just struck out. What matters is that I behave impeccably when I compete. The guy believes in his talent. What he doesn't believe in is himself. He sees himself exclusively in his statistics. If his stats are bad, he has zero self-worth. He's never developed a coping mechanism because he's never had anything to cope with. Billy's view of himself was radically different. Baseball hadn't yielded itself to his character. He thought it was just bullshit to say that his character, or more exactly, his emotional predisposition, might be changed. You know what, he said. If it doesn't happen, it never was going to happen. If you never did it, it wasn't there to begin with. All these attempts to manipulate his psyche he regarded as so much bullshit. Sports psychologists are a crutch, he said. An excuse for why you are not doing it rather than a solution. If somebody needs them, there is a weakness in them that will prevent them from succeeding. It's not a character flaw. It's just a character flaw when it comes to baseball. He was who he was. Baseball was what it was, and they were a bad match. It wasn't anyone's fault, he said. I just didn't have it in me. During spring training of 1990, he finally capitulated to this realization. He no longer was a boy. He was a man. He had married his high school girlfriend, and she was 7 months pregnant with their first child. He had responsibilities and no real future to cover them. He had gone from promising to disappointing without ever quite figuring out how or why. But he wasn't blind. All he had to do was look around to see that something had changed. The luster and the shine came off because there was a whole new crop of guys coming in, he said. I was 27 years old, and by and large, you are what you are when you're 27. He had blossomed into the physical specimen the scouts had dreamed he would become. And yet somehow, the game had shrunk him. The game had also rendered him unfit for anything but itself. The people on the big club assumed that Billy would break camp in 1990 with them and spend another season shuttling between the bench and AAA. Billy did something else instead. He walked out of the Oakland A's dugout and into their front office and said he wanted a job as an advanced scout. An advanced scout traveled ahead of the big league team and analyzed the strengths and weaknesses of future opponents. Billy was entering what was meant to be his prime as a baseball player, and he'd decided he'd rather watch than play. I always say that I loved playing the game, but I'm not sure that I really did, he said. I never felt comfortable. When their fifth outfielder turned up looking for a desk job, the A's front office didn't know what to make of it. It was as unlikely as some successful politician quitting a campaign and saying he wanted to be a staffer, or a movie actor walking off the set and taking a job as key grip. None of the staff had played big league baseball, and all of them wished they had. Most would have given their glove hands, or at least a few fingers, for a year in a big league uniform. The A's general manager, Sandy Alderson, was maybe the most perplexed of all. Nobody does that, he said. Nobody says, I quit as a player. I want to be an advanced scout. He hired Billy anyway. I didn't think there was much risk in making him an advanced scout, Alderson said, because I didn't think an advanced scout did anything.